Pastor Ryan Meeks made a pretty big announcement earlier this year. He's the founding pastor of the Eastlake Community Church, which has about 3,000 members spread out across 5 different locations around the Puget Sound region. Would you, how do you feel, Ryan, about the term megachurch?
Well, I wouldn't say it's my favorite word. We never set out to be a megachurch. We set out to be a community of people who are trying to live true.
And just so you know, since I forgot to say this when I was out in Bothell talking to Ryan, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect.
Even so, the announcement that you made kind of struck people as being unusual for a church with your kind of characteristics. And the announcement was basically that Eastlake would be affirming in a very public way gay and lesbian members into the church and into the church leadership.
The question to me is, how many more kids need to commit suicide before we start taking this seriously? And at least, whether you agree with me or not, at least saying the fruit is bad. Something has to shift.
Can you tell me the story of what led up to that announcement?
The real tipping point for us, honestly, was when a staff member and close friend came out to me. And she knows us quite well. We go backpacking together. I mean, we're actual friends. And when she came out and was weeping about it, thinking that, you know, I know this might be my last day here, it was just like a cold shiver down the spine. Like, how in the world can this person who knows us so well think we would reject her? How many more people are a part of our community who love our church but are just waiting for the second shoe to drop, you know? And so I just realized I need to be explicit.
What would you have thought about making such a public and explicit statement about it some years ago?
Honestly, I think I was afraid. In my world, I've seen what happens to people who come out for full inclusion, and so I was probably afraid. So much had changed in my heart. I mean, I'm not the same person I was 5 years ago. I actually find it hard to put myself in that place and imagine how that guy used to think. What was way more of a concern to me was being true to myself, regardless of the fallout or what kind of consequences came that way, because the worst thing to do would be to live untrue.
What kind of consequences have come?
Oh, gosh. I know people laughed and we lost a considerable amount of our budget.
You said in your State of the Lake talk, your budget was down about 50%.
Yeah. But again, it is what it is. You know, this is not a career for us. It's a calling and a vocation to live for the flourishing of people. So that part kind of makes the consequences or whatever else seem kind of silly.
Pastor Ryan Meeks is founding pastor of Eastlake Community Church. He's based here in Bothell and across their 5 locations. And earlier this year, he announced that the church would be fully welcoming and affirming gay and lesbian members into the membership and the leadership. And it's stories of changes of heart that we are bringing to you today on Sound Effect from KPLU. Why a change of heart can be so frightening and lonesome, but also exhilarating and can bring you to a kind of inner peace. So don't go away. In a little bit, we're going to hear from some people who have really done a 180 on what they think is important and where they're headed. But our first story of a change of heart is much more literal. Autumn Rush was born with a heart condition. And maybe you've heard of people who are born with a hole in their heart. Well, Autumn had 2 big ones and a whole bunch of tiny ones.
My first cardiologist described it as looking like a BB gun had been shot at my heart, and that's where all the little tiny holes.
As she got older, her heart got worse. And then when she was about 14, she started feeling pretty awful. Bad enough that she went to the hospital and stayed there for weeks. And things did not get better.
I felt really horrible one day. I woke up and I knew something was wrong. And they came in and they realized that my heart rate was above 300 beats a minute.
That's hard to even imagine.
I can't imagine it now. Like, when my heart rate goes up to 160 when they do my stress tests, like that, it feels like it's jumping out of your chest, but I can't imagine 300.
That's 5 beats a second.
It's just crazy to think about. So yeah, they had to stop my heart and restart it with a new rhythm.
So what happened after that? They got you restabilized.
Yeah. My mom and I were woken up at 5 in the morning, and we heard some movement outside the room. But then the nurse came in, and they said that they thought they had a heart for me. And so later I found out that it was from a 16-year-old girl who was in a car accident in Alaska. And that's all the information I ever found out. And then, yeah, I had my transplant that day.
So how did you first confront your own responsibilities for taking care of yourself?
Well, some of it was with my mom at the very early age. She was like, I was 6 years old. I was calling in my prescription drugs myself.
She did that? She wanted you to do that?
Yeah, she wanted me to do that because it's my medicine. It was like, if it's you're going to be doing this the rest of your life, you need to participate in some of this. And then when I was, I think, 9 at summer camp, I had hid my medication in my bag and told my cabin counselors that I just didn't take the meds anymore.
Why?
I had always been forced to take them. And I was like, I just want to see what happens if I don't take them. And within like a day and a half, you could definitely see the effects. Fluid would gather in my abdomen and my face and neck. So my face would start to swell like really big. And I was at a camp with a bunch of my cardiologist doctors and nurses. So it was kind of obvious. I got in a lot of trouble, was forced to take them again. And it reversed really quickly. But I really credit that experience as to why I'm really always on top of my medication now.
So for people who don't have that experience young, when they're a teenager, all of a sudden the ball's in their court to figure out how they're going to handle their own care. What would keep somebody like that from staying totally on top of it? What would keep a teenager from doing everything he or she can to stay healthy and take all their medications and go to the doctor when they need to and all that stuff?
Well, there's hormones going on. Like, especially male, they're more likely to die that if they have a health condition in adolescent, teenager, young adulthood. All except for one of my friends that are male from growing up have all died.
You mean to friends who are transplant recipients?
Transplant and other health issues.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, even it's just it's a testosterone thing, I swear. It's something wrong with that that chemical.
Can you tell me the story maybe of somebody who you know who confronted that and wasn't able to keep it together?
Yeah. So I had one that I only found out passed away after the fact. We had known each other since infant. We had grown up in the hospital together, gone to camp together. Every time one of us got sick, somehow the other one got sick, and we were always in the hospital together. And he got his transplant a year before I did. But he found out that he was in rejection, and he decided to put it off because to go in for treatment for it because it was the first day of ski season. And then he ended up dying up on the mountain that day. So that was a hard one. That was like 9 years ago.
I'm really sorry.
That one wasn't particularly very difficult because I've known him for so long. Such a senseless, like, you could go skiing tomorrow, like, going for treatment.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things where a healthy young person can make that kind of dumb choice. But there's just no wiggle room when you're dealing with being a transplant recipient.
Yeah.
So when you were a teen going into adulthood and getting ready to leave, you know, a pediatric setting and go into an adult care setting, did you struggle? How did you do with taking charge of your own care?
Well, mine was a little bit different. My mom was still involved, but I moved out when I was almost 16 in with my brother. My mom still took me to all my appointments, still took me to all of my biopsies and all the things like that. But the blood draws, it was my responsibility. It was like a half a block away, and make sure that I had all my meds.
Yeah, and eating right and doing all that kind of stuff. Yeah. When you're 16 years old in a household with no adults.
Yeah.
How did you wind up in that house all by yourself with your brother?
I'm a stubborn person. And my mom, she got back together with her ex-husband and she moved back up to Bothell. I really wanted to move to West Seattle in an apartment with my brother, and she wasn't sure about it. But since 16 is kind of the age when you can legally be emancipated if you fight for that, she didn't want to do all that. So she just was like, we'll set you up in an apartment with your brother. We'll make sure that child support money from my dad went to pay for some of the rent.
Well, I was going to ask you how you talked her into this. And so you had a bit of a club, right? Because you could just say, well, I'll legally emancipate myself.
Well, yeah, it was kind of, she doesn't want to ever take that kind of step.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's really courageous, or maybe reckless of you.
Bullheaded.
Right? I mean, how are you feeling about that decision looking back on it?
Now I think that's probably one of the ways that maybe I'm still here, because I'm coming up on 20-year anniversary, and I personally, I don't know anyone out of my transplant group that's been out that long. As far as I know, they've all passed away, but I'm not totally sure. There's still a couple that I don't actually know personally. But yeah, I think it was kind of in my hands whether I lived or died.
This is a difficult question to ask, but what are your expectations around your own life expectancy?
Well, they don't really know, because all the data they have is mainly from adult transplant recipients. I think it was in like the early 90s they started doing transplant on adolescents. So I'm part of that generation of, and they don't really know yet. I was told from the very beginning that my match was really good. And so I haven't had a lot of the issues that some people have.
So how are you with the uncertainty around that, given that even medicine doesn't know what your outcomes are likely to be?
I try to still... I mean, I still look to the future, obviously, and I'm not sick at all. So I don't expect to go anytime soon, but that's still part of reality. At any moment, my heart could decide that it's done.
Yeah. So you work at Children's now.
Yeah.
And I know you here and there have some interaction with some of the young adult transplant recipients, right?
Yep.
So what do you tell them? If you had to give them some advice on how to kind of navigate that transition into adulthood and out of the care at Children's and into an adult facility as a transplant recipient, what do you tell them?
Well, I generally always say that you know your body better than anyone in the world. If you think something is wrong, it most likely is, and you need to pursue that with all of your being you have. But I don't know. Teenagers are a hard group. They don't always want to listen. I mean, I didn't want to listen when I was a kid. But it is possible to survive and take control. It just takes an act of will.
Well, Autumn Rush works in the playroom at Seattle Children's, and she's going on 20 years now with her new heart. Thank you so much for joining us on Sound Effect.
No problem.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Change of Heart. The sax man you're hearing right now is Anton Schwartz. He's a widely respected jazz musician, and he recorded this song right here in our KPLU studios last week. ¶¶ Schwartz splits his time between Seattle and San Francisco these days, and he's taught music at Stanford Jazz Workshop. He's been an artist in residence at Harvard. But before he was a full-time sax player, he was on a very different career path. He spoke with Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestedt.
When I was in college, I was interested in math and computer science and philosophy and psychology. And I went on to artificial intelligence, which is under the rubric of computer science.
I think a lot of people probably have a different idea or have their own idea of what artificial intelligence and the work in artificial intelligence actually is. So can you explain what you were doing?
I was interested in an area called machine learning, which is, as you might imagine, getting machines to learn, getting them to arrive at behaviors, ability to give answers to questions, ability to perhaps navigate in an environment when they haven't been taught how to do it. So I was interested in getting computers to learn more the way babies do, when they're just kind of fumbling around and they start to develop concepts and then build bigger concepts on littler concepts and build wrong concepts and then have to update them. And
So you had this, it sounded like, were you passionate about artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I was, it was a great thing. I was on an NSF scholarship. I was an NSF fellow. I was on a National Science Foundation fellowship. They were giving me free rein to do whatever I wanted, the coolest thing I could think of.
Right? And what were you doing?
I was working on machine learning, doing research, inspired by my notions of what it's like to be in the world, which happened to be very different from the direction that most of artificial intelligence was going in at the time. It was pretty idyllic, really.
You changed to a musician. You became a musician. That seems like a pretty radical change to go from the artificial intelligence field to the jazz world. Was there a moment where you said, this needs to happen?
It happened. It took me by surprise. I decided that even though it was amazingly cool to be thinking about these things that I was thinking about and working on the things I was working on, I just wasn't really happy with that life. For me, it was a life of more isolation than I wanted. And I was a good mathematician, but I wasn't a brilliant mathematician. And I was an undergrad at Harvard where the math majors were, just scary people, the kind who, become professors at 18, 19 sometimes. Those people show up. If I had had that kind of ability, that's the point at which it becomes like an art. But I wasn't born an engineer, right? That wasn't in me. So I wound up putting that on hold with some help, by the way, from my body, which decided to get sick with kind of a chronic fatigue thing. It said, hey, wake up, you got some thinking to do. So I did some thinking and some soul searching, decided to walk away from academia, and was in the process of exploring other possibilities when music kind of crept up on me.
How did it creep up on you?
Well, I went into the practice room because I literally didn't know what to do with my time. I had cleared out everything to be able to knock off my doctoral thesis. So I kind of had an empty slate, and which is a very difficult place to be when you all of a sudden don't know what you want to do. So I spent time in the practice room because I knew that whatever time I spent doing music, it was not going to be time that I would ever regret.
Do you regret all of that work that you put in to getting to the point to be in this artificial intelligence industry? Do you regret putting all that time and effort into it?
In ways, I do. I mean, I definitely do wish that I had spent more of those formative years playing music, because it really has quite an impact, the hours that you spend at an early age.
Well, it sounds like with artificial intelligence, you just kind of reached a point and kind of had this epiphany that you liked it, but you didn't love it. Could you ever see that happening with a saxophone?
Interesting. Interesting question. I don't really ever see myself stopping the saxophone, but I'm not one of the people who will give you an answer that my life begins and ends with the saxophone and with jazz. It's just an expression of humanity. I feel extremely privileged to grow up in a country, in a city, and with a background where, you know, I had this notion that I ought to be able to follow my passion and that that would lead to support me in some sense. You know, I just never thought of academia as a means to an income. But there turned out to be a cognitive dissonance that I was feeling that was so profound that it really, got under my skin and kind of made me sick for a while, you know? It my body sort of said, hey, you don't belong here. You know, I ponder so often how many great mathematicians, jazz musicians, scientists, philosophers, doctors, poets we would have, you know, if many of the people who are just struggling to get by had the chance to really follow their dreams. And follow your dream, I mean, it sounds so rose-colored. What I mean is to work hard and to be rewarded for that and, you know, explore their passions.
Sound effects, Kevin Kniestad. You can hear and see more of Anton Schwartz playing the sax at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This week, we're exploring what it means to have a change of heart. Britt Marie Hermes had her first change of heart when she was a teenager, and it came during a bout of psoriasis. So she went to the doctor, and that was all it took.
In my memory, the dermatologist was this old man who was quite impersonal and gave me the diagnosis very matter-of-factly. And I remember asking him about other options to treat psoriasis, and he was very cold about it. And the response was, this is it, kid. You're going to have psoriasis for the rest of your life. Your best treatment is steroids, and that's that.
That experience got her curious. Were there other ways of treating her ailments besides just swallowing whatever that jerk of a doctor decreed? She threw herself into research, and she discovered natural medicine. It became her passion and eventually her profession. She went to school and into practice here in Washington as a committed naturopathic doctor. But that fervor would later turn sour, and it would lead to an even bigger change of heart. We talked over Skype, and she explained how that first doctor's visit set her on this whole complicated journey.
It led me to believe that medicine doesn't have all the answers, and it led me to be weary of what medical doctors tell me is true. I came to believe that maybe some conspiracy theory by pharmaceutical companies or information being withheld from the government, let's say, was almost like naturopaths had some special information source. Like we knew things that other people didn't know.
A lot of that access to information comes from Bastyr University, which is based here in Kenmore, Washington, and it's one of the more prominent institutions for educating naturopathic physicians and other natural medicine practitioners in the country.
Yeah, I was thrilled to find Bastyr when I did. Bastyr has a great reputation for being the more science-based, evidence-based naturopathic school. And I thought I was receiving an education that was on par with that of a medical doctor's because that's what Bastyr and their accrediting agency, the Council on Naturopathic Medical Education, says. And I didn't realize until I was out of school and actually had left the profession that I realized that my education was not on par with that of a medical doctor. The clinical training that naturopathic students receive at schools like Bastyr is far less than what medical doctors receive.
What did you make of it at the time?
It was exciting. I was learning so many new things at once.
Yeah, that must have felt good to get access to information you feel like you didn't have access to before and that a lot of other people don't. You're on the inside now in some ways.
I remember calling home and telling my parents about all of these exciting new things I had learned or listening to a friend describe symptoms and saying, oh, that sounds just like the homeopathic remedy I learned about today in class. Or hearing about a niece or a nephew with an ear infection and telling them, oh, well, if you cut up an onion and heat it in the microwave and place it next to the ear, that onion juice and aroma can help pull the infection out of the middle ear, and we call that an onion earmuff. So these were the exciting, novel, folky novel treatments that I was learning, and I was excited to share them. But then when I started to see things that I could not be a part of, it changed everything.
What were some of the first signs?
Well, there was an accumulation of small events from having heated discussions about whether or not vaccines should be used or antibiotics should be used in patients that were clearly sick with infections. I was seeing missed diagnoses, wrong diagnoses, and eventually I saw an instance of an egregious malpractice involving a naturopathic colleague who specialized in naturopathic cancer treatment. And this colleague was repeatedly committing a federal crime.
And I'm assuming you don't take those kinds of terms lightly when you're saying malpractice and committing a crime.
No, I don't. After I discovered this, I immediately handed in my notice to the practice where I was working and notified the authorities.
What was the action that you're characterizing as a crime?
Well, it was the use of a non-approved medication for a diagnosis. And I don't want to go into much more detail than that because there may still be a federal criminal investigation going on.
So having a change of heart around this profession also means kind of making a break with all of these colleagues and friends, I assume, right? These must have been friends of yours by now. So what was that like to be pulling away from this community that you had become part of?
Well, it's been very difficult. It's not just a change of heart, it's a change of identity. Who I thought I was has changed. I never would have considered myself a skeptic. I thought it was so incredible that something like naturopathy existed. And now I think it's so dangerous.
Did you find that you were encountering parts of your personality or beliefs that you have, and you're like, holy cow, now I need to rethink all this piece of it?
It's been very difficult. I'm still going through it. There's been a lot of grief, and I still feel that sadness. And I catch myself in these funny habits. And they're only funny to me now. You know, when I hear about a new vaccine being developed or a vaccine side effect, that fear part of me comes up. Well, oh gosh, is this vaccine really safe? How many people are getting injured? Are we over-vaccinating our children? Do I want to vaccinate my children? That thought still comes up, which is amazing to me still. I still have a few sort of naturopathic-y remedies tucked away that I don't even think about, like, oh, my probiotics or my tea tree oil. And I will stop and catch myself and wonder, is this really doing anything? And if I stopped taking the supplement, would I notice, would I feel any difference? And so my day-to-day life has changed dramatically. And every once in a while, I'm reminded of what it used to be like. And it's very bizarre, actually.
Yeah, you must feel like you are multiple people in some ways.
I still feel like I'm multiple people. I totally get it. When I hear a patient complaining about his or her appointment with the medical doctor or bouncing around from doctor to doctor and not getting answers and then sitting in a naturopath's office and feeling heard for the first time, I understand that. And when I hear about students being afraid of going to medical school because they don't want to be rushed, pill-pushing, unempathetic doctors, I totally get that.
That said, are there things that you miss about your old life?
I miss my friends, without a doubt.
Have you had to sacrifice some of those friendships because of the change you made?
I would say all of my friends.
All of your friends?
I'm not in contact with a single one of my friends anymore.
What is that like?
It's awful. It really is, because I don't know how to effectively communicate to them how I see the field of naturopathy. And so we just end up in a stalemate of a conversation. And I don't know that my friends can accept to be friends with someone who is actively working to prevent the progress of their profession.
Britt Marie Hermes lives in Germany now, where she's starting a new career in scientific research, and she still writes about her experiences in naturopathy and her thoughts about it at the Naturopathic Diaries. We're going to link to that at kplusoundeffect.org. And meanwhile, that's obviously just one side to this story, and we figured there are plenty of people whose change of heart goes in the opposite direction. So I checked in with Bastyr University to see if they wanted to respond to Britt's take on this and to see if they knew of somebody who had gone from conventional medicine to naturopathic medicine. And they said, yeah, how about our dean? Jane Giltinen is dean of naturopathic medicine. That's how she pronounces it, by the way. And I caught up with her at her Seattle clinic.
I wanted to be a doctor from the time I was in the eighth grade. I was always fascinated with medicine, although I must admit I was very fearful of needles. So I entered undergraduate studies and chose medical technology as my major.
And when you say you wanted to be a doctor, I mean, at that time you were talking about being an MD, right? A traditionally educated medical doctor?
Oh, yes. I had no clue what naturopathic medicine was at that point. It was traditional medical doctor in a white jacket and a stethoscope walking around the halls of a hospital with a clipboard. That was my sort of vision of it. And during the course of my 8 years as a medical technologist, I began to see conventional medicine in a different light and get a little bit discouraged about it. And what I saw happening were people coming into the hospital, getting patched up, leaving the hospital, coming back to the hospital, getting patched up again, leaving the hospital. What I didn't see was any intervention to kind of break that cycle. So I really became disillusioned. At this time, I still had not heard the word naturopathic. I just serendipitously found out about naturopathic medicine, but the moment I heard the word, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
How did you find out?
I was at a women's music festival in Yosemite National Park, and I was volunteering at the first aid tent to work off some of my registration fee. And I was doing my shift, and I heard in the other end of the tent a booming voice say, "I'm a second-year naturopathic medical student." And it was this cliche light bulb moment or electric bolt moment. Just hearing the word, I wanted to do it.
So at that time, you were still working in a conventional medical setting. You must have had friends who were doing that kind of stuff. I mean, that was sort of your universe a little bit. Was it difficult to begin to pull out of that world?
It wasn't at first because I was so excited about it. But when I got here, it was called John Bastyr College of Naturopathic Medicine then, I realized, oh, this is not going to be the wonderful, easy path to a career that I had hoped it would be. In fact, I would acknowledge that after 2 years of naturopathic medical school, I thought about transferring to conventional medical school because I was so concerned about the future of our profession.
Can you tell me more about that? What was going through your mind when you were weighing those things?
I was in a jurisprudence class learning about the laws around healthcare in the state and the country. At the time I was in school, only 7 states licensed naturopaths as doctors. And the attorney who was teaching the class basically said, if you're planning to practice anywhere except in a licensed state, you better plan to be practicing under a rock or you might go to jail. And so that was, you know, a little bit scary, but I stayed the path.
The world that you came from values experimental repeatability, evidence-based practices, when traditionally science-based medicine shines those light on naturopathic medicine. A lot of times they say there's no
underpinning for this type of practice or that type of remedy or so on. Do you have that voice in your mind? Is that still there?
Absolutely. I am a advocate of evidence-informed practice and evidence-based medicine. We've had NIH grants to help us improve and increase the teaching and practice of evidence-informed practice here, and I wholly embrace research and science and reproducibility of studies to document that what you do actually works. And if you find out that it doesn't, that you discard that practice.
But Baster definitely still has certain kinds of modalities that traditional science-based medicine would say is not based on evidence, right? I mean, things like homeopathy. Do you feel that that has a strong enough evidence base to warrant teaching it at the university?
I think homeopathy is, you're choosing one of the more controversial modalities or tools that a naturopath has in their tool belt. However, many medical doctors also practice homeopathy. That is not a naturopathic-owned modality. There is some evidence for homeopathy. It's mixed. Many of the studies are small. There are flaws in the studies. I remain open-minded to the testing of homeopathy and sensitive to the perspective that there's little strong evidence to support homeopathy, but we still do teach it, and many of our patients will testify that it's been very helpful to them.
I guess finally, you know, you said that it's not uncommon for people to make a transition from conventional medicine to naturopathic medicine. You must encounter those types of students a lot. How do you advise them? What do you tell them about how to navigate that kind of change?
You should be prepared to be questioned, to have skeptical friends and colleagues who think you might be crazy, and be prepared not only to be a good healthcare provider, but also to be a good advocate for the profession. I didn't want to do politics. I just wanted to be a doctor. But going into this profession, I realized, oh no, we're also going to have to be advocates.
Dr. Jane Giltinen, who is the Dean of the Naturopathic Medicine Program at Baster University, thanks so much for being on our show.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. Warren Langford is our senior executive intern, and Casey Hicks is our chief operating intern. We get web help from Dave Nogueras, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Special thanks to Jason Hopper Cruz of Seattle Children's for educating us on the heart transplant program there. You can find us on iTunes, subscribe to our free podcast, and write us a review. And don't forget, we want your questions on Northwest etiquette for an upcoming show. KPLU manners expert Dick Stein is going to be offering his advice. Send your query to soundeffect@kplu.org, or you can tweet at KPLU. We welcome your feedback while you're at it there. And meanwhile, we'll be back next week talking DIY.
Open yourself up to trying, and don't hold yourself back by saying, well, I've never done this before. Because everything you do, you've never done before at one point.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.